welcome to episode 13 of the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. America's national security interests hinge on weather. Few would guess this, it's something we take for granted, but whether we look at General Eisenhower choosing when to launch the D-Day invasion in the spring of 1944, or the type of munition that we deployed off of an aircraft today against a fleeting high-value target, it all comes down to weather. For the warfighter, lack of knowledge of current and future weather conditions can literally be the difference between life and death. That's why it's critical that we field the latest technology available to collect and analyze weather imagery and other sensor data to give our frontline operators the real-time weather information they need to execute their missions. But the current satellites that create the backbone of our Defense Weather Information System, the Defense Meteorological Satellite Program, or DMSP for short, has aged out and a replacement system is well overdue. So today, we are going to discuss how we can help address this situation. To kick off the episode, I want to pull in Lieutenant Colonel Johnny DeRay to really lay down what weather means to the warfighter. As an MQ-9 Reaper pilot, Johnny's ability to fly and fight hinges on accurate weather information. Johnny, great to have you here.
Hey, thanks so much, Slick. I really appreciate the invite. It's an honor to talk today. I love the Mitchell Institute and everything they're doing, and it really is an honor to be here just talking to you today about the RPA and specifically the MQ-9.
Well, sweet. We're excited that you're joining us from an austere location. I know it was a little bit of work for you to get the time away, so thanks again. What I'd like to do is have you walk us through a typical mission, because clearly the MQ-9 is remotely piloted, so you are on the ground flying the aircraft. You're relying on numerous data feeds to have the situational awareness to execute your mission. So how does weather information and forecasting factor into this?
Yeah, no, great question. And you hit the nail on the head. So we're in the RPA world, there's two different crews that fly a typical mission. So you have the launch and recovery crew that's going to sit in theater, and they're going to launch the aircraft and get it up to a certain altitude. And then back here in the States, you're going to have your mission or your MCE crew. The technical term we like to use is grab the aircraft at a certain altitude, and then they're going to go execute that mission. So before the mission or the MCE crew grabs the aircraft, they're going to go through a typical flying brief, just like any other manned air crew would. And that's going to include weather. Now, that weather brief is, generally speaking, going to cover an entire country, an entire AOR. And really, that's because during a 16, 17, 18 hour MQ-9 mission, you can get pushed to a variety of different places. And so that weather brief just encompasses the entire AOR we're looking at, just because you never know where you might end up going. So in the world of ISR and kinetic strike, I mean, weather does play just a monumental role in what we do. And there's just a couple points I want to hit on. First and foremost is that, the cameras don't see through clouds. And so when you're looking at executing a mission that requires image intelligence or IMIT, that's going to be impossible if you have a very thick cloud deck that you're trying to look through overhead. Secondly, kinetic options, I'll say particularly ones requiring a high degree of precision, accuracy, and dynamic targeting, they're going to be severely limited when your cloud cover rolls in. So that's an aspect of this as well. Third, I'll say the MQ-9 is not an all-weather capable aircraft. There's no weather radar on board. There's no lightning detection. There's very limited anti-ice capability. And it's not a weather penetrator. It's also extremely dependent upon electrical control. So a lightning strike for an MQ-9 aircraft is really kind of a death sentence for it. And then lastly, and this is the point that I really want to foot stomp, when you're flying an RPA, and again, particularly an MQ-9, you can't just look outside and see the weather changing around you. So when you're in some of these theaters where the weather is rapidly building up, dissipating, and changing, you can't see that happening around you. Yes, you have a single camera, and you could basically bring it up, zoom out, and do a 360-degree scan to try to get an idea of what's happening. But if you do that, you're giving up target custody for whatever you're looking at on the ground, and a single 360-degree scan is still not going to provide you the level of awareness that you need. So generally speaking, in the MQ-9 community, we know we're in weather and starting to have trouble with it whenever we're looking through that soda straw down at the ground and we see clouds start to kind of appear in our feet and we have that hair rising up on the back of our neck kind of oh crap moment. We kind of probably need to pay attention to the weather right now because it's changing.
Well, Johnny, I really appreciate that rundown. I know our listeners are going to be tuned in to how weather affects you just to basically operate the airplane, not just get into it tactically. So with that, I want to ask you, is there any mission that sticks out in your memory to where weather was a deciding factor in achieving or not achieving your mission objectives?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could literally talk about dozens of different ones because weather is such a crucial factor for the MQ-9, but I'll pick one in particular. A few years ago, overhead a target in the Middle East. The target that day was a vehicle with a technical in the back, which is just a fancy way of saying a very large gun. And Intel had reported and seen throughout the day one of those one of the violent extremist organizations using that vehicle with the technical in it, driving by friendly outposts and checkpoints and firing on friendlies and things of that nature. So our mission that day was to strike the vehicle with a Hellfire. The problem was the vehicle was oriented in an alleyway north to south, so we had to thread the needle a bit between the buildings to hit it with a Hellfire. And just as challenging as we had weather that day. And so weather was basically causing us issues around about 75% of the orbit that we were flying. And the real problem was that it kept changing rapidly to the point where we couldn't predict it. So we would look at a map and we'd try to figure out, okay, we're on the west, this part of the orbit looks like weather's a factor. And then we break out to the south, but then we're back into cloud cover again in the east. And the problem was the next time we go around, it would be totally different. And so we never felt comfortable enough to execute a strike because we just didn't know when weather was going to come in, play a factor, and cause us to be blind to the target. And so fortunately for us, a few minutes later, a manned aircraft arrived on station as well. And so we reached out to them and said, hey, this is what we're trying to do. You guys are up there in the manned aircraft. What do you see with the weather? Because we just can't see it right now. And they said, hey, it looks like, you know, they're just building up in certain spots. It looks like if you go to the north right now and you hold up to the north, you'll be able to see the target. And we see basically from what we're able to tell on our side of our aircraft that in about 5 or 10 minutes, this weather should kind of dissipate and move off to the west. And you might have an opening then. And that's exactly what happened. We moved to the north. We kept eyes on the target. About 10 minutes later, they reached out to us and they said, hey, it looks pretty clear now. If you want one of those north to south or south to north running headings to execute. So we did a practice run or two. Everything looked like it should. And we went and executed the shot successfully. But the point was that without that up-to-date real-time weather information, that shot would have never happened. We couldn't afford at that point to take our sensor, our single camera, off the target. We had to keep it on the target the entire time, so we couldn't scan. And we really needed that just real-time weather awareness to execute that strike successfully.
Wow, it's incredible. Now, another thing that comes to mind is risk management, which is an obvious key component into executing a successful mission. Now, what would happen to the level of risk on a mission if the weather satellites were not available to you?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And the answer, you know, bottom line up front is just that it would absolutely skyrocket. Like we discussed previously, the MQ-9 is not an all-weather bird. It has long, thin wings that don't like turbulence very much. The wings cannot fend off ice very well. Hail will destroy the honeycomb exterior pretty quickly. And so with no onboard weather detection capability, we're really at the mercy of the weather forecast, and we have to play extremely conservative with everything when it comes to weather. We can't pick our way through bad weather. We can't determine what the openings are. We just have to stay away, which drives us away from certain mission sets because we just don't have the ability to accept risk. And so the other thing that stands out to me is without satellite coverage, you're going to be accepting a substantial increase first and foremost in just losing an MQ-9 period and losing the aircraft itself. I think secondly, without that satellite coverage, you're going to be looking at just an increased likelihood of what I'll term wasted ISR. So again, getting overhead a target area where you're looking to collect that image and that video intelligence. And if you get overhead an area that's just completely socked in and you don't know it until you get overhead, you can end up burning just hours of time up there, not really doing a whole lot simply because you can't execute your mission because of the cloud cover that you were unaware of. And I think third is that you just accept a substantial increase in the risk of a kinetic failure on a kinetic strike mission, simply because you'd be planning in the blind without that satellite coverage. Many of the target sets we're going after give us extremely narrow strike windows based on their pattern of life. And without knowing the weather overhead during those windows, you'd be rolling the dice every time you send an MQ-9 on a kinetic mission, just hoping at that point that the window of opportunity for the strike aligned with a window of opportunity for the weather as well. And so we like to say that, you know, in the military that hope is not a COA, and that's true. But I would tell you without weather satellite coverage, hope would absolutely be a COA for many of the missions we'd be going after at that point.
Well, Johnny, I really appreciate you being here today. Thanks so much for the clear insight into how weather affects you on a daily basis.
Yeah, no, again, thanks so much for having me, and honored to sit down and talk with you, and hope we can do it again sometime. Thanks a lot.
To understand how we get predictive weather information, you need to understand how the Space Weather Enterprise functions. Sensors on a satellite observe the Earth's atmosphere. So think about the satellite imaging the Earth across optical and infrared spectrums. This weather data is downlinked to processing centers like the Air Force's 557th Weather Wing in Nebraska. From there, warfighters can gain access to data like cloud coverage in an area where they'll be flying. Importantly, the data can be processed and fused with other information streams to improve both long and short-term weather forecasting for areas of interest. The U.S. military currently uses the DMSP constellation of weather satellites. The first generation of this system was launched in the late 1960s. Over the following decades, improved DMSP satellites were launched, with the last of the series launched in 2014. They had a general design life of about 5 years once in orbit. So now we are relying on satellites that are well past their design lives. This means that the DMSP satellites in orbit could fail anytime, and we need to get serious about a replacement program. Now, given all this discussion, it's fair to ask if I can get weather forecasts for my smartphone good enough to plan where I can fly my personal airplane, why does the warfighter need a dedicated space-based weather capability? This is a fair question, and to help explain the drivers behind this requirement, I'd like to bring in Mitchell Institute's Director of Research, Major General Retired Larry Sutream, onto the show. While most know him for his time as a fighter pilot, he also served as the director of the Air Force's Weather Enterprise. This included serving as a U.S. Air Force deputy to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. That is the civil side of the weather business. So he worked firsthand with the DMSP program. Stutz, welcome to the show.
Hi, Slick. Nice to be here.
Well, you know, we just spoke to Lieutenant Colonel Johnny DeRay, and he explained his take on weather's role in combat aviation. But I would also like to hear your take on the importance of defense weather to the warfighter.
Good, Slick. Let me start with a wake-up call I had just following 9/11. I was involved in planning and directing operations for Afghanistan during Operation Enduring Freedom, and I was in the Air Operations Center in Saudi Arabia. And to begin, you know, weather was a huge factor in our operations in Afghanistan. We lost some precious aircraft due to unknown weather. We had ground forces in situations where weather interfered with their safety and protection. And we didn't even have the ability to see current weather images overlaid on our operational pictures. So we had a case very early on in the first days where a CH-47 helicopter crashed in the mountains and Taliban were closing in on the crash site. So we sent a MQ-1 Predator over to provide overwatch. And from that Predator, we could carefully command and control a rescue mission. We could advise the guys on the ground about threats around their position. But because of a lack of weather information, we lost the Predator to icing in clouds that we had no awareness were in that vicinity. And I'll tell you, Slick, if it wasn't for a few miracles that night, the situation would have been a propaganda coup for the Taliban globally. It would have been known that the United States had this massive failure. Of course, they would have had the prisoners. It would have been a setback for all of our theater operations, and precious lives most likely would have been lost. So this was a case where a lack of defense weather information had simultaneously a tactical, operational, and strategic effect all at the same time. So across the warfighting complex, you've got to think of defense weather capabilities as a tremendous force multiplier. It allows not just increased effectiveness of, say, getting bombs on target, but it creates tremendous operational efficiencies.
Well, sir, has the need for weather support to the warfighter changed over time?
Well, that's a great question. Weather has always affected the warfighter, as you know, Slick. However, I look at World War II, part of the famous bombing survey that came out in 1945, had carefully analyzed what happened and the impact, specifically impact of forecasting on bomber operations. And they found, it may seem simple to us today, but they found that forecasting produced a significant efficiency in air operations. But it wasn't just about whether aircraft could launch or not launch. They had a tremendous appreciation for how forecasting improved the effectiveness and efficiency of planning well before takeoff. And also in World War II, of course, there's an example, prime example, during the invasion of Normandy in 1944. And here's where weather forecasters were basically the pivotal piece. On the planned date, there was a bad period of weather, about 3 days of bad weather forecasted. And so the invasion was delayed. But there were three forecasters who carefully looked at all the data they had and believed there would be a 24-hour reprieve the very next day. And they convinced General Eisenhower to proceed with the invasion of Normandy. Well, the Germans missed that break in the weather. They were very relaxed on their posture because of it. And so you might say weather superiority in the hands of the United States and its allies paved the way for victory. It saved the day. Thousands of lives saved because of that bold move on that day. And then we saw later in Korea and Vietnam, our adversaries were timing their operations during periods of bad weather. Slick, you understand this. We had this asymmetric advantage of our air power. And they knew that. And they knew that bad weather at that time kept it, you know, well on the ground. And so that's when they operated. So as you asked, you know, what about today? How's it changed today? Oh, my gosh, the speed of operations has so accelerated. Concepts such as joint all domain command control, advanced air battle management. It, by design, these concepts seek speed and tremendous speed of decision making. And as a result, you know, requirements for more precision, better forecasting, more precision tailoring to specific missions, all that becomes much more critical. So the quality of weather data has vastly gone up in terms of that requirement. I will say, even today, and we'll see this for the next many decades, counterterrorism and counterinsurgency operations are launched based upon a red light, green light that comes from the weather assessment. So all across the complex, we can see that weather is only becoming more critical to combat operations, not less. Now, sure. I've got a story I might throw in, Slick, here.
Please do.
That it's in Afghanistan. I think you would appreciate this. This was 20 years ago, and we had some air liaison officers up at the Army Tactical Operations Center up in Bagram. And 20 years ago in Afghanistan, it was bad as far as weather information and awareness. And we one day had, the weatherman had told us the entire Afghanistan was red. We couldn't operate. But you and I know that weather is not like that. It's not like a blanket. It's like Swiss cheese. There's holes all over, but the quality information was not good. And so this Army general pulled our air liaison guys outside, and he points up at the blue sky and says, "Why are you not flying?" And it was an embarrassing moment. It went all through the system. And so the goal is, how can I have weather help me or enter my plan where I am right here, anywhere in the next 30 minutes, day or week?
Yeah, that's a great point, sir. One thing I wanted to ask you is, why does the Department of Defense need their own dedicated weather satellites?
Great question, Slick, and we need to educate a lot of people who are going to make decisions on this capability. There are three reasons. First, where we plan to fight, there is not the weather information we need. Secondly, we need operational security. Even if we can get the information from commercial sites, those are not secure, and that betrays our operations. And third, we need assurance that information is not going to be interrupted. And so we need our own system. Our allies, key allies, may not agree with what we're doing in our operations, and they'll pull that support. We have examples of that in the recent past.
Sir, what would be the operational impact if we didn't have a dedicated space-based weather sensing capability?
That's a huge impact. It's catastrophic. You know, with what I just said, we would not have weather in most of the places we fight. And remember that Normandy example. We need that superiority. Our adversary will use weather against us. So we need this capability. And by the way, you know, let me just remind you that the defense space weather sensing is not just for the services, but it also supports the intelligence community, our defense leaders, other government agencies. It optimizes their readiness and their operations.
So with that, what is the next step in space-based weather technology, and how does that differ from the older capabilities that we have today?
Well, the modernization of defense weather sensing from space has stumbled. Let me just say that frankly. The DMSP constellation that we have today is way past its lifespan, way past. And it reflects 20th century technology, and that's supporting 21st century warfighters. Since I was director of Air Force Weather, there have been at least two failed attempts to recapitalize defense weather satellites. I recall in one case, there was an attempt to combine many government agency requirements. It was just too complicated, and it was compromising what the Department of Defense needed in its military operations. It was destined to fail. What's interesting now is the EWS program that's underway in the acquisition process. And this not just is new stuff, it uses new space design concepts and state-of-the-art sensors that can really provide the kind of support that things like JADC2 and advanced air battle management need to function properly.
Well, sir, something I don't need to tell you, but military operations are all about risk, and it's both the risk of failure and the risk of losing assets. So could you speak to us a bit about how risk changes as we transition out of DMSP and into EWS?
Yeah, yes, I can, and very enthusiastically. We have to be aware that in today's warfighting environment, there's been an advance in counter space capabilities by countries like China. And that means that old design concepts, both for space and sensors, that involve these massive, heavy satellites congested with sensors, they create single points of failure. For example, EWS, its design is by nature more durable. It'll have more resilience. Because it's a distributed series of small satellites, and that makes it also more upgradable throughout its time on orbit. But the main risk I see, Slick, is in the world we have ahead of flat to declining budgets. If folks miss the leveraging power of environmental intelligence, that is weather, and funding for EWS gets disrupted, or something programmatic disrupts the timeline for being operational, that's where I see the risk to the warfighter. So if possible, for the sake of the warfighter, if we could, EWS should be accelerated.
Well, Stutz, as always, thank you so much for your time today, and thanks for being on the Aerospace Advantage.
Hey, you bet, Slick. Thanks so much.
With the DMSP constellation on borrowed time and EWS not yet in orbit, what about the present? We have a 3-year gap when the risk level will be high. To help explain the current state of play, I'd like to bring on one of the key industry voices who is focused on this mission. Nick Bucci is the Vice President of Program Management at General Atomics. Most of you will recognize General Atomics from their work on the Predator and Reaper remotely piloted aircraft. But the reality is that General Atomics is deeply involved in nearly all operational domains, including space. Well, Nick, thank you so much for joining us. The first thing I wanted to talk about is the basics of space-based sensing, because it's obvious that it's expensive to build and launch satellites, and what makes space... So we're trying to figure out what makes space such an advantageous place to put these sensors outside of the Earth's environment.
Well, thanks for having me, Slick. Space really does provide the ideal place for sensing because it provides essentially easy global access, right? When I'm in space, I don't have to negotiate rights to place sensors or even to share information amongst sensors that maybe are owned by individual entities, countries, territories, et cetera. So it really provides you that global reach that you need. And it also provides you the opportunity to collect all different kinds of information, and frankly, share different kinds of information in terms of communications as well. So it's really that global access piece that's important. One of the back to your original point about it's expensive in terms of getting things in space. Space-based sensing in particular generally has required very exquisite sensors, which generally can be very large, very heavy, require lots of power. And then that kind of translates into what's required of the spacecraft that they're being carried on to carry out their mission. A large spacecraft requires a large launch vehicle. And so that's really where the costs start to roll up, is when you get into, you know, exquisite sensors that have to last for a very long time because they're expensive. So we want to get the most out of them from a lifetime perspective. And all of those things kind of accumulate one on the other in terms of driving up the price of space, at least in the, I'll call it the old space paradigm. And now we're in a tectonic shift into the new space paradigm, where we can take advantage of a lot of technology. We can take advantage of a marketized launch provider marketplace. And all of a sudden now space can become more accessible, more reasonably priced. And now we can do a proliferated constellation, which a lot of people are talking about, for a much more reasonable price. I like the way General Hyten phrased it a few years ago when he talked about disaggregation of satellites. Instead of building a few very large, exquisite satellites, I can take advantage of technological advancements and build a constellation that has as good as, if not better, capability, but that is taken advantage of the fact that I can build these sensors and communication links in a much smaller size, weight, and power requirement. Therefore, I can put them on smaller satellites. I can proliferate those satellites. I can launch several of them at one time and take advantage of the low-cost launch providers. And now I have a much different business case, if you want to call it that, for sensing from space.
Let's talk about the alternatives. If we were to try to do this on the ground or in the atmosphere, what would we be thinking about as far as like relative cost?
To be honest, I couldn't even imagine to provide the same coverage in terms of the ability to cover the entire globe, to be able to get revisit rates. Many years ago, I worked on a weather surveillance program for the terminal area of airports. And, you know, we were looking at sensors that were in the $5 million range in the 90s, and they were going out 60 miles. Imagine covering this country with sensors that did that. Now, there were other versions that could do a longer range and things like that. But that only gave you certain things. It didn't give you the full picture, and it certainly didn't do it on a global scale, right? And so to be honest, to get that full global coverage and the kind of revisit rates that you want to be able to produce the weather products that, you know, warfighters are dependent upon to do their missions, I don't know that you could put a price tag, a sensible one anyway. And I hate to kind of go back to General Hyten again, but he is a very good person from a space perspective on the thinking behind things. He talked about the sensing from space for the missile defense mission. And he said, we wanted to do this back in the 80s. And every time we do it, we start down the process and we come up with a satellite constellation that's just too darn expensive. And so we build another sensor, a radar, and put it on an island somewhere. And that fills, you know, holes in coverage, and we kind of use that as a fallback position. Realistically, if we can get to the place, like we just talked about, where I can build that constellation for a sensible cost, I now don't fall back on band-aids and minimal coverages that don't get me to what I really want, which is that global coverage. So I don't know that I could put a price on what it would cost to do this from the ground. I mean, access rights. I mean, if I wanted to provide the entire world with sensors, I don't know what it would cost to go to some country and ask them, you know, can I place a sensor here? And frankly, if they had a sensor, would they be willing to share their data with me? I'm not so sure they would, especially in times of conflict. So I think it becomes a difficult problem to do it in other areas.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It just doesn't seem like anything from the ground or even on a on an aircraft flying in the atmosphere would provide the coverage that space can do for us. Transitioning and talking about the DMSP program that's sustained defense needs for so many decades, as you know, well know, it's a first generation design satellite. How will the EWS system design be different from DMSPs?
What we're trying to do on EWS is take advantage of the fact that I can build very good sensors today at a much smaller size, weight, and power, and be much less expensive, but still get all of the weather products, all of the information that a warfighter needs from that sensor. That smaller sensor then allows us to put that on a smaller spacecraft. That smaller spacecraft can take advantage of much more commoditized parts. And now I can build a constellation because it's smaller, it will be less expensive, and I can proliferate that capability. So now I can extend the capabilities to a much larger constellation that can provide me the revisit times and the coverage that I need at a lower cost. And so it's really the advantage of taking advantage of the technological evolutions. You know, the Moore's law always applies to, you know, processor chips, but there are analogous capability improvements over time in other technologies, and infrared sensing is one where we see a constant improvement in the capabilities, and taking advantage of that and being able to get inside that, I like to call it the technology fire control loop, where technology is moving faster than I can build satellites. It doesn't do me any good. I can't take advantage of it. But if I can build satellites within that technology development fire control loop, now all of a sudden I can take advantage of it and bring new things to the warfighter. And that's what we're trying to do on EWS.
For our listeners that might not know, can you compare and contrast a little bit how this distributed system of smaller satellites could offer a better capability than what DMSP in their approach currently is doing?
Well, it comes down to the sensors, and it comes down to the ability to essentially provide that faster revisit rate and a lower latency. So in terms of the sensor, if you can build a sensor that can provide you all of the information that you can currently get out of a DMSP system and like systems, that being able to make it smaller can now let me proliferate that across, again, these multiple satellites. Now I'm collecting all of the information I need on that one satellite, but now I can proliferate it at a lower cost. And so I can get that information faster. I can get it with a lower latency, and I can provide it more often with the same or in some cases higher quality, because you can add new capabilities and not significantly increase the size, weight, and power of your sensor. And so that will help provide more capability, certainly as good as, but certainly we look to provide more capability as we go forward.
Right. Now, General Sestrium explained what you're describing and how current and future warfighting concepts will just need rapid data. And what I really want to get to is we understand now the processing power of the sensors and the capability, but how do you see this improved capability from EWS affecting the warfighter directly?
Well, I think every mission that a warfighter goes to perform requires weather information. You know, from the simplest things of the cover of night to the literal fog of war, the tactics, techniques, and procedures that any warfighter from, you know, a space guardian, an airman, a soldier, or a sailor, they look to having the right kinds of information to be able to set their tactic, techniques, and procedures to carry out their mission. Weather sets limitations on sensors. It sets limitations on communication systems. It sets limitations on maneuverability. And so knowing what the weather situation is will define the order of battle for any warfighter to be able to execute his or her mission. As we go forward, getting that information more accurately, getting it faster, getting it sooner in terms of from the point of collection to the point of use is extremely important in being able to set the right course of action for that individual warfighter. So I don't know of any kind of situation that a warfighter can perform without timely and accurate weather information.
So the United States Space Force is planning for a launch in 2024 of EWS, and some folks have proposed that a gap filler could be used between now and then. And how might the implementation of a gap filler actually work against the warfighter in the long run?
Well, frankly, if that gap filler is relying on existing technologies, you know, off the shelf or older technologies, you'll end up getting that gap will reappear. A better solution would be to essentially accelerate the EWS program to produce that gap filler, because what that will do is essentially not only fill the gap, but it will automatically set us on path to getting the full up capability that we want that will meet the JROC's requirements and get to that full up constellation that meets those latency requirements and meets those revisit rate requirements. So rather than taking a step backward to put a Band-Aid on something, let's take a step forward and get a step toward the ultimate goal.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for your views and the discussion today. I personally have learned a lot about a program that I knew a little bit about, but I really appreciate the explanation.
Well, thanks for having me, Slick.
I think our conversations today have clearly illustrated that the information about the environment, and I'm not just talking about the weather, is a make or break factor for the warfighter. And this requirement is not going to go away. Next generation operational concepts like ABMS and JADC2 are going to demand better real-time environmental information because they will see mission assets rapidly tasked in a highly dynamic mission environment. This demands matching the right set of tools to the conditions in a given region. To this point, deciding between a laser-guided bomb or a GPS-directed weapon is largely a weather decision because lasers cannot be employed through cloud cover. So, warfighters need precise, fresh, assured, and secure weather gear. Lives depend on it. Trust me, I've been there. It is that simple. With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning in to today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.